The House Committee on Human Service, Finance, and Policy will come to order. The Committee Legislative Assistant will note the roll. Also want to note, as a housekeeping piece, as the room starts to fill up and people wake up, if you could please keep the aisles free. We've had some issues with that the last couple of days. We do have a quorum present, and Representative Knutson moves the approval of the minutes from February 12, 2025. Are there any additions, changes, or corrections to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and the minutes from February 12, 2025 are adopted. Today we have our guest from the Department of Human Services here to present on the governor's budget and to hopefully introduce themselves for the committee. So that is all we have on the agenda today. So please budget your time as you wish throughout the next hour and 45 minutes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. For the record, my name is Shireen Gandhi, and I'm serving as temporary commissioner for the Department of Human Services. I am on day 9 of this role. Since 2017, I have been at the Department of Human Services, serving in various roles that support operations as deputy commissioner, assistant commissioner, and chief compliance officer. I came to DHS from the private sector with 22 years of experience in healthcare, primarily working for providers, hospitals, health systems, trade associations, and surgical societies. A significant portion of my career has been focused on quality of care, process improvement, and compliance. And at DHS, I led the creation of a compliance oversight system designed to help us keep track of issues and resolve them. And in all of my roles, including now, I continue to champion process improvement and strengthening our internal controls. As much as we've accomplished to date, this is work that is never done. And so there is always more to do, and I've been encouraging everybody at the Department of Human Services to continue with our continuous improvement mindset that was instilled in the agency many administrations ago and continues on to this day. I look forward to working with you all in this temporary capacity until a permanent DHS commissioner is appointed. So at DHS, we have had a positive shift in our mission and vision from seeing our work as helping to meet people's basic needs to helping people thrive. Our mission is, in collaboration with community and partners, DHS supports people to thrive in community and live their healthiest and fullest lives. And our vision is that all people in Minnesota have what they need to thrive in community with no disparities. And it's aspirational, but we've done it at least once. We've renewed people on Medicaid after the COVID unwind through the pandemic. And in that effort, we had no disparities in re-enrolling black people and most of the Native American community, with the exception of elders, when we disaggregate the data. So we're determined to continue on this path and keep working to achieve our vision. DHS also continues to be a top state in health and human services. And just a few highlights for you is that we are the fifth state nationally overall for health, according to America's Health Rankings in 2023. Drilling down a little more specifically, we are number one nationally for older adults and people with disabilities, according to ARP, the Commonwealth Fund, and the SCAN Foundation. We are fifth nationally in child well-being for providing high-quality supports for mental health, and including in schools and other appropriate settings. And that's from the Ann EKC Foundation in 2024. And also, we are 11th nationally in healthcare access, quality, and outcomes according to the Commonwealth Fund in 2023. And I will hand it over to Elise to start with our budget presentation.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. Before we get into the proposals within the governor's budget this year, we thought we would just give a brief overview of what our budget looks like so we can look at those in context of where we are today. Before we get into the numbers, I always like to point to the people and the people that we impact across the state. So DHS directly impacts more than a quarter of all Minnesotans. And when you drill down into who is receiving services and impacted by the programs that we run, about 45% of kids across the state, 25% of adults and parents, 17% of older adults, and 28% of people with disabilities. I like to center our conversation around that because the decisions in this committee really are impactful to every inch of the state, and so we should kind of keep that at the forefront. Our budget in fiscal year 26 is around $24 billion, and more than half of that is from the federal government. So we have about $12.6 billion in 2026 coming from federal funds. When it comes to the general fund, it's about $9.4 billion, and the healthcare access fund, about $1.1 billion. This slide just kind of briefly goes over, on average, how many people we served in fiscal year 24. So around 1.3 million people received healthcare through Medicaid. Over 100,000 people received healthcare through the Minnesota Care Program. Drilling down deeper within those numbers, 12,000 people received long-term care in nursing facilities. 89,000 people receive long-term care in their homes and in their communities. This committee also has jurisdiction over the Behavioral Health Fund, and that's where we're funding services related to mental health and substance use disorder. In fiscal year 24, we served over 30,000 people with that funding. Within the MA program, over 830,000 families with kids are receiving health care through that program. This committee also has jurisdiction over a few of our other forecast programs, such as general assistance, assisting people with disabilities meet their basic needs. Over 20,000 people in 24 received services under that program, as well as housing support, assisting people to maintain and keep their housing. Over 20,000 people in fiscal year 24. So, as I said, every inch of the state is impacted by Medicaid and the programs that DHS serves. This slide goes over looking at different regions and what is of the total population within that region, how many people receive health care through the Medicaid program. So the largest concentration of the Medicaid use is in the northwest corner. About 28% of people living in that corner of the state receive their health care through Medicaid. When you look just at kids, it's about 50.5%. And you can see the remaining quadrants of the state and those relative percentages. As I said, more than half of our budget comes from federal sources. And so it's really pivotal on what's happening on the federal side on when it comes to Medicaid. As of this current fiscal year 2025, we're receiving about $15.9 billion from the federal government. So looking at our budget over time, you can see from 2016 to 2027, it's risen and then is kind of going down a bit due to a few dynamics that I'll like to point out. So, of course, the pandemic occurred in 2020 and 2021, where we started receiving additional funding from mostly from the federal government. And the majority of that, when it comes to DHS, was around our Medicaid program and receiving a federal enhanced match for the services provided during that time period. Once the pandemic ended, we then had to begin the process, as Commissioner mentioned, on re-enrolling folks through the unwinding process. So that's when we were checking every single person receiving healthcare at that time and ensuring that they met the eligibility requirements for the program. At that time, then, fewer people are re-enrolling on Medicaid due to that unwinding process. And then the other dynamic is splitting into three agencies. So starting in fiscal year 25, our Children and Families program moved to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And then in fiscal year 26, our direct care treatment programs will move on their own agency. So that's what you'll see in 2026, where our budget finally will land after that split. In the green line, you'll see, so you could see a kind of an apples to apples. If those aspects of our budget weren't as part of DHS back in historical times, what our budget would have looked like at that time. So what do we spend our money on? About 89% of our funds are spent on the Medicaid program. 6% are spent on other forecasted programs, such as the Behavioral Health Fund, Housing Support, General Assistance, and Minnesota Care. 3% of our budget is spent on grant programs, and then 2% is spent on operations. So that is FTE costs, staffing, and our IT costs. So the MA program, on average, across the entire program, we receive about 54% of federal funds for that program, but that will vary based on the population served and the services. So it's pretty complex digging deeper into the data, but on the aggregate, we received 54%, or we will in fiscal year 26. About 42% of kids are receiving health care through Medicaid, 1.3 million people. And in fiscal year 24, we spent about $19 billion, all funds on the program. So digging deeper, so within the MA program, about $10 billion in fiscal year 26 is estimated to be spent on long-term care and waivers. So these are facility-based care, nursing home care, as well as long-term care provided in a person's own home. That's about 46% of our expenditures on the Medicaid program. Beyond that, the three other bars are our basic care eligibility categories. So elderly and people with disabilities, basic care, that's about 21% of the MA budget. Families with children is about 20% of the MA budget, and 13% is adults without kids. This is all funds, and so it will depend when it comes to state funding how much we get for a federal share. For example, adults without children, we receive a 90% match versus elderly and people with disabilities, it's about 50%. So looking deeper into kind of the details that we'll discuss in this committee, looking at the spending trends on long-term care, that is the biggest part of our budget that is growing. And you'll see it's growing both in the number of people that we're serving as well as the average cost per person. So in the green line here, you'll see the average people we served each fiscal year, and the blue bars are our total expenditures. Slide 14 goes over the average monthly payment by type of program. So you'll see in the teal line above, that is the long-term care facilities. So that is nursing homes and ICFDD, or intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities. The line below is our long-term care waivers and our home care costs. So both lines are going up over time as far as how much we're paying per month per person. We've come a long way in this state as far as how many services are available to people and how people choose to receive their long-term care. Prior to 2000, most folks received long-term care in facilities, so in nursing homes and ICFDDs. And since that time, that gap has widened from people choosing to receive care in their homes and in their communities. Slide 16 just goes over a snapshot in fiscal year 23, what services people were receiving when they were receiving long-term care support. So 47,000 people were receiving PCA services. 46,000 people were receiving care on the disability waivers in their own home. 23,000, were on the disability waivers and receiving residential services. So things like group homes and assisted living or customized living services. Our elderly waiver program served 38,000, so that is a program that's serving people in their own home and community for people who are over 65. And 21,000 people received home care, and 17,000 people at that time were receiving care in a nursing home. So disability waiver spending is the largest growth, and you'll see here in this graph what it looks like by waiver type. So CADI waiver, we're seeing the largest growth in terms of total spending, but within that, it's in terms of number of people served as well as total cost per person. We also are seeing growth in the DD waiver as well, so you'll see that in the green part of the graphs. So why are the costs going up so drastically? And there are a number of levers, and Mr. Hardy kind of discussed those, I believe that was yesterday in committee, but this drills a little bit further down into why we're seeing growth in the forecast. So just generally, we are seeing that more people are accessing long-term care, and there's a lot of drivers within that. Generational shifts, of course, where more people are aging and need care through the home and community-based or long-term care service continuum. We are seeing nationally that the prevalence of disability is increasing, so that's also a component within why are we seeing growth in the number of people accessing services. When it comes to the disability waivers, we are seeing growth in people choosing care through that, that option under the Medicaid program. Many years ago, we had a cap, and so there were wait lists, and people had to wait a long time to access care. Since that cap is lifted, we've looked at the data on are there different trends we're seeing once that cap has been lifted. And we are seeing some interesting trends in that more younger people now have access to long-term care and home and community-based services more than they had before. So we're seeing growth in kids. We're also seeing growth in older adults, as I mentioned yesterday in committee as well, in accessing long-term care in the disability waiver services. We're also seeing increases in racial diversity in waiver services as well. So the other lever is services. So what are the services that people are choosing to access and how much? So we're seeing in the data that more people are accessing, as I showed in the slide before, they're choosing to access care in the communities rather than in facilities. And that does impact where they show up in our forecast and where the costs are occurring. We're seeing increases in the number and type of services authorized and billed in the disability waiver program. So we're seeing a large growth in the number of services authorized. And the way the infrastructure works is the lead agency works with people accessing disability waivers to authorize services on their behalf, and then finding providers and authorizing those services with the providers, and then the providers are billing. Most times there's a gap in between authorized and billed, and so we looked at both of that. Is there an increase in the authorized services? Is there just an increase in billed claims? And we're seeing that it's more on the authorization side. So people are choosing with their plan when they're working with the counties more services in terms of the number of services as well as the number of units. And the difference between authorized and billed is relatively constant from historical times. Residential services continue to be a large cost driver in the waiver program. So residential services generally cost 3 to 4 times more than a service plan for a person if they were living in their own home. That has gone down a bit on the DD waiver in terms of the percentage of people receiving residential services. But on the CADI waiver, it's maintained relatively constant. So because we're having more people accessing the waivers, it means on the aggregate, more people are receiving residential services, and that's adding to the cost of the program. We're also seeing increases in non-residential services and disability waiver programs. So I've listed a few of the services that we've seen in the data that people are accessing more than they had before. And we're seeing a decrease in the use of lower cost state plan services. So we have a few home and community-based services on the state plan, such as PCA or now CFSS and home care. And we're seeing more people receive services on CADI, for instance, than in the past they may have received through state plan services. The last lever I'll mention is payments. So we're seeing an increase in payment rates, and a lot of that had to do with some of the really important investments this committee made in the last few years, where we had limited growth in rates, for example, in the elderly waiver program that impacted providers' ability to attract and maintain staffing. So some of that is in the data, of course, on really important investments that you all made. We're also seeing some increases that weren't expected. For example, in the November forecast, we're seeing inflation adjustments in the disability waiver rate system that are higher than what we originally had anticipated based on previous trends. So those factor into the forecast and the cost going up. Of course, value-based reimbursement in nursing homes, those costs are going up. Since VBR was implemented in 2017, the aggregate increase in rates is around 100% or just over 100%. So that does add into the amount of costs that we're seeing in the forecast. I would say again, those increases are important in order for providers to maintain staffing. So what we'll talk about here with the governor's budget recommendations, these are challenging decisions to make because it's a push and a pull on making sure that people have access to service and the provider can attract and maintain staffing and ensuring that we are maintaining a reasonable level of cost growth. For the disability waivers, so the disability waiver rate system is based on average costs, and the way the system works is if a provider is serving somebody with exceptionally high needs, they can work with a county to request a rate exception, so to go above those average costs. And we're seeing growth in the use of that. Around a quarter of our spending on DWRS is in exceptions, and within that, 90% of that is in residential services. So that's much higher use of exceptions than originally anticipated. And so you'll see some proposals in the governor's budget narrowing in on what should qualify for a rate exception, making sure that people with higher needs do have access to that, but making sure that it's really centered around the person's need. So very quickly, going over some non-MA forecasted programs, we spent about $1.4 billion in 26 on this part of our budget. Around 47% of that is in Minnesota Care. 17% is in the Behavioral Health Fund. And then housing support, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, general assistance, and alternative care are on the bottom part of the graph here. And those are fully funded by the state, so they don't have any federal match for those programs. We also have grants. I think it's around 3% of our budget is grants, and you'll see the big drop in fiscal year 26 on the number of the amount of spending we have on grants. And this is mainly due to the children and families programs shifting over to the Department of Youth and Children, Youth, and Families. And you'll see that on graph 21, where in the green bar, these were the grants that we had implemented in fiscal year 24, and in fiscal year 26, that's the amount of spending we'll have in each kind of category of grants going forward. And just quickly on our administrative budget, our budget has grown over time in total, and our amount of FTEs has maintained relatively constant. So the percent or overhead amount has actually decreased over time from 3% early in this graph to around 2% overhead. And then on slide 23, just goes over compensation, so FTE costs, as a percent of our total programmatic costs. So it's around 1%. So I just wanted to keep that in mind as we go over some of the proposals. We're requesting FTEs for administering things like program integrity. It's really important to keep in mind that our budget has grown over time. That means we're paying more claims, we're serving more providers, we're serving more people, and we need the administrative resources to oversee and have oversight over the program that is commensurate to the growth in our budget. With that, we'll go into the budget. So some high level around what is our budget centered around this year. We're really looking to strengthen our administrative capacity to do those program integrity aspects of the program. There's some items in our budget that are trying to mitigate steep fiscal cliffs that are caused by either one-time state funding or drops in federal funding. So you'll see a few of those. Of course, the majority of our budget is really centered around curbing increased growth in spending, and all these are really challenging decisions to make. So we look forward to working with the committee on what those look like and ensuring, you know, our goal is to ensure the least amount of impact on people. So we look forward to working with you on those. And then lastly, you know, maintaining and increasing our operational effectiveness at the department to oversee the programs in a way that serves people, the people of Minnesota, well. Slide 25 goes over a summary of what our package is in this jurisdiction. Across the 4 years, it's about a $1.3 billion reduction in spending. And with that, I'll pass it off to my colleague, Assistant Commissioner Mers, to go over the disability changes.
Thank you, Director Bailey. And for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Natasha Mers, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Aging and Disability Services at the Department of Human Services, and pleased to be here this morning to present components of the governor's budget. So the first item is investment in community first services and supports. So just to ground the committee, community first services and supports is a redesign of our personal care assistance program. We decided to, in collaboration with the legislature, move that benefit into federal authorities that offered additional flexibilities for people using those services. So we are in the midst of implementing or making that transition. But it is safe to say that the proposals in the governor's budget apply both to PCA agencies and CFSS workers, regardless of where either the agency or the person is in the transition. So those things will remain static. So this is this proposal is related to a collective bargaining agreement with SEIU that represents workers and between Minnesota and SEIU. And so a couple key components of note here. Increasing rates for experienced workers. So the policy rationale behind this is really that when we have direct support professionals that are working with people and have a lot of experience, you know, they've worked for many, many years, that their skill level goes up and therefore their compensation should be commensurate with that. So this proposal adjusts rates upwards, which allows then the employer of those providers to pass that along in the form of wages to the worker. Similarly, the enhanced rate is a program where people that receive PCA or CFSS services, when they have a level of medical complexity to their care and their worker also takes required training, that they get an enhanced Medicaid rate. So this proposal increases the enhanced rate for medical complexity from 7.5% to 12.5% in terms of a rate add-on. And then also really trying to make sure that workers are properly trained and oriented to the role that the vital and important role they play providing services to individual people, increased compensation and stipends as compensation to reimburse workers who have taken certain training and orientation. Similarly, stipends for healthcare costs, and also a study on how the state might be able to think about providing healthcare coverage for these workers down the road. So a lot of innovative initiatives here to think about how to stabilize this really important sector of our workforce. So those studies just are important policy levers for us to be able to understand what the choices and options are to bring back in terms of recommendations. And then finally, funding for a web-based or an information technology matching system to allow individual workers to connect with people that are looking for direct care workers so that they could then employ them and use CFSS as the service model to provide services. Okay, so the next components of the governor's budget include provisions to control the growth in spending under the disability waivers. So Director Bailey kind of explained the context of the growth in spending and some of the drivers behind that. So what these next couple of proposals that I'll walk through will reflect what we've understood in the data as cost drivers and try to align those with policy rationale, with policy goals of the department. So as Director Bailey mentioned, we are seeing increasing unexpected increases or unanticipated increases in the amount, the number of people receiving rate exceptions, and then the amount for those exceptions. And so we think that this is an opportunity, you know, when roughly a quarter of this population is receiving an exception, it's time to then take a look and see, do we need to create some more program integrity parameters to make sure those rate exceptions are needed and documented based on assessed needs. So this would put some limitation on what qualifies for an exception and require additional documentation requirements about the person's exceptional needs and make sure that those documentation is provided year over year when those exceptions are renewed. And the final part of this particular budget proposal is rate input monitoring and oversight. So DWRS stands for Disability Waiver Rate Spending Systems, and so what that is basically the rate setting, the policy rate setting mechanism for how these services are reimbursed to the provider, what the provider bills for. So in this context, what this means is that when providers sort of fill out rate sheets that go in and kind of go into the DWRS calculation machine, if you will, we want to make sure that the inputs that the providers are putting in, the number of staff that they're needing, the type of service being provided, that we have some oversight and insight into that those services are actually being provided in the community. So they're put on the rate sheet, but then they need to be delivered pursuant to what's identified on the rate sheet and approved within our Medicaid payment system. So this would put some administrative resources to be able to establish monitoring systems to make sure there is, again, the services delivered are matching the rate inputs. All right. Next component relates specifically to residential services under the disability waivers. So as Director Bailey mentioned, that includes things like group homes, community residential settings, integrated community support settings, and other provider-controlled settings. These are cost drivers that we've seen in the growth in the forecast, as you've just seen. So there's a few different kind of levers or components of this proposal that relate specifically to residential services. The first being a limitation in the amount of days that a provider is allowed to bill. So even when people live in residential services, we know that it's very important that they get out in community, that they spend time with their family, whatever that means to them. And so this assumes that people spend a certain number of days outside of the residential provider's care, and Medicaid doesn't, you know, you typically have to receive the service for Medicaid to reimburse. So this would put a limitation, kind of a more standardized limitation on the number of days, which we call an absence and utilization factor, sort of absence from that setting, just to kind of lay out what the verbiage means. Limit access to all customized living services for people under 55. We have been in the process of trying to transition people 65 and under from customized living, which is the Medicaid service delivered in assisted living settings, move them over to different residential service models. And so this transition, we've tried really hard to make it a smooth transition, but it has been very confusing. There's a lot of moving parts. It's a very technical policy to comply with. And so thinking about that in addition to the cost drivers, this would limit access for people on custom 55, under 55, they would go to different waivered services and not access customized living. That really is designed to serve people 65 and older in its purest form. Overnight staffing. So looking at rates being paid for staff to be, you know, staying with someone overnight and having some variation whether that staff is awake versus asleep. And then finally adding a 5% county share on the state component, the state share for residential services in provider controlled settings. So not all waivered services, but the residential service component. And finally, regarding disability waiver growth, day and unit-based services. So just to note what are day services are services that are considered a provider-controlled setting, but people don't live there. So they might go there to a day service either to, you know, do something that's meaningful for them in the community, to be able to give respite to primary caregivers at home, to it, you know, to go to work or kind of get to work or do other type of employment services. So this is an important service for people. And we want to make sure that we have sustainable programs to mitigate growth going forward. So individualized home supports, so that's related to the absence and utilization factor for day services. So bringing that down to, from 9.4% to 3.9%, which is aligns with our other DWRS waiver services related to absence and utilization. So I talked before about when someone's living in a group home, we assume from a rate perspective that they're going to spend a certain amount of time away with family or other caregivers, and the provider's not going to be billing for those services. Absence and utilization factor, that same concept applies for day services. We assume that if a person's going to day services, they're not necessarily working 365 days or volunteering 365 days a year, that they have life that happens and they do other things during certain portions of the year. So bringing that factor that's in the rate framework down from to 3.9% and aligning with data and other similar services in terms of absence and utilization factor. Finally, night supervision, creating a new rate for night supervision when the staff is asleep rather than when staff is awake. Right now, it's one rate regardless of asleep or awake, and we think those are different service models that should have some different reimbursements. All right. Next one, reducing growth through capping inflationary adjustments. So our DWRS services do have inflationary adjustments that occur automatically based on data that comes out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Consumer Price Index. And so this proposal, rather than have those inflation amounts be determined by those two data sources with and not being able to kind of predict or understand what that's going to look like, this proposal limits the increase, the inflationary increase to 2% per adjustment. And finally, I'll just note, you can see on the screen that within DWRS, there's a lot of different services, a lot of different moving parts. And so these proposals do have interactive fiscal impacts. And so we just want to note that as we're thinking about, you know, how we think about the final budget package of negotiation, they all affect each other depending on which options or which things move forward in terms of this committee. All right. Moving on to nursing facilities, a proposal here related to nursing home payment rates. So first, as just a little bit of context here, the federal government has changed the way it will reimburse states for nursing facility Medicaid costs. They're moving away from a system called a RUG system that, you know, assessed for acuity in a certain and particular way, and they're moving to a PDPM model or a patient-driven payment model. So no matter what, Minnesota needs to make a transition. We can't use the old system or the RUG system that we have been using. So the proposal in front of you here allows for a transition to PDPM to make sure that we can continue to pay providers and access the federal data and maintain compliance with that. And it also includes some additional spending decreases to our current value-based reimbursement system, including it repeals an annual alternative payment system property rate inflation, phases out closure rate agreements and single bed incentives and layaways, and it'll limit the amount that the rate inputs for health insurance costs for individual employees, and will limit inflationary growth by setting, again, a maximum of 2% per year in operating costs. And then a proposal related to the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. So this is a relatively new entity that was created to ensure that staff in nursing homes receive appropriate compensation, wages, and benefits, and that the Medicaid rates reflect what those costs are. So this proposal includes funding to effectuate wage increases for workers in nursing homes. Effective 1/1/26, the wage floor increases from $19 to $27 per hour. There is variation depending on which type of staff, whether it's a unlicensed CNA versus an LPN or an RN. So just to note that. And that effective, again, on $1,127, an additional increase from $20.50 an hour to $28.50 per hour. So increased overtime in the biennium. And with that, I will pass it back to Temporary Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher. Since stepping in as temporary commissioner, I've been meeting with OIG managers, looking at the data, meeting with DPS Commissioner Bob Jacobson and Superintendent Drew Evans. And I wanted to share a little bit about what I've learned about our current program integrity work. We have a strong team and they are eager to do more. So currently, our Office of Inspector General prevents and detects fraud, waste, abuse, and error, and takes action when they find it. They have a variety of tools that they use to do this. They investigate, the investigations come from both tips and data analysis. And they have tools at their disposal to take action, but we could use more, and I'll cover that in the coming slides. Our team works closely with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the Department of Public Safety, the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and also federal partners like the Office of Inspector General for HHS, as well as county law enforcement. And a few facts for you. We have completed over 4,000 investigations in the last 5.5 years, stopping payments to 750 entities. And another big topic has been the Feeding Our Future fraud that's happened in Minnesota at another agency. And one of the things that we've learned through that is we need to be able to share data better. But with the data we were able to receive, we had a team of from our OIG as well as our grants office and attorneys looking at all of the individuals that we learned about that were involved in that scheme, the bad actors, and looked in our own programs to see if there was fraud. And we did not find any fraud happening in DHS by any individuals other than a few that our Office of Inspector General was already on top of. Recently, our team has gone out and done site visits, and on this slide it says to 164 autism providers, but actually that slide is already out of date because our team is actively going out and visiting places, and that number is up to 179 now. And in the last 10 years, we've also seen, as Director Bailey said, significant growth in spending through the MA program. And that spending has outpaced our staff. So the oversight and investigative work of our team finds bad actors that prey on taxpayer dollars and put services at risk for families and children. And over 80% of the time, when you hear about an investigation by the Attorney General's office or our federal partners, DHS referred those cases to them. So looking ahead at the governor's proposal, the next two slides focus on a comprehensive approach with multiple strategies to strengthen the state's ability to detect, prevent, and investigate fraud, waste, and abuse. This includes increased staffing in our program integrity oversight operations to increase our capacity to investigate fraud, waste, and abuse. An important data point to remember is that for every dollar that we spend on this, our return on investment is $1.89, and that brings in additional revenue or cost avoidance for the state of Minnesota. We'd also like to increase staffing in the agency's provider eligibility and compliance unit to strengthen our ability to conduct provider enrollment and prevent potential fraud from occurring on the front end. And also increase staffing for internal controls and audit investigations, and funding to contract for prepayment review of claims for high-risk providers to prevent improper payments. Also, as part of this proposal, we would like expanded authority in licensing, payment withholds, and data sharing. This would give agencies clearer authority to share data so that we can move more quickly to take action. When we see fraud happening in one agency, we can move much more swiftly across all of our agencies to stop that and to investigate and prosecute it. We'd like to expand authority to immediately suspend a program license if a controlling individual, not just a license holder, is criminally charged with offenses such as fraud or theft. We'd like to allow for payment withhold when there is a criminal conviction related to fraud involving another state or federal agency. We'd like to allow for a payment withhold when a license is revoked or suspended by DHS or another state or federal agency. We'd also like to allow for payment withhold when somebody has a background study disqualification. This proposal also would clarify the statute of limitations when pursuing recoveries from surety bond companies and clarify the substance use disorder midpoint rule, which is about how much you bill in an hour, to ensure accurate billing of claims. And lastly, expand oversight of managed care organizations' compliance with program integrity requirements. The next budget proposal is related to analytics infrastructure. And over the past 10 years, as Director Bailey said, the growth of MA spending has outpaced the growth of our staff and oversight functions. Our investigations are very time and labor intensive, with our teams sorting out mountains of paperwork and data in order to determine if there's fraud, waste, abuse, or error. We need to use technology to get ahead of the criminals. They are always upping their game, and we need to up our game too. So what this proposal recommends is that we use proactive, scalable, data-driven approach to our work. For Medicaid data, we want to be able to use new strategies using technology to analyze the mountains of Medicaid claims we have. Again, we serve more than 1 million people in Minnesota, and every single visit is a claim. So we need better tools to sort through that data and get ahead of any fraud that exists. We also want to use advanced analytics and artificial intelligence for Medicaid oversight to detect patterns, assign risk scores, and flag high risk cases for investigation. And lastly, we want to conduct data-driven audits and investigations. And to help with that, we're recommending a new case management system that will automate alerts, streamline investigations, and improve collaboration between auditors and investigators. The next proposal is about new background studies disqualification that would prohibit an individual who is under active investigation for fraud from holding any position involving ownership, management, or control or billing activities in the program for which the study is conducted. This new authority would allow us to disqualify people under active investigation for fraud from working in programs serving children, vulnerable adults with billing access, and receiving public funds. The next proposal is also about background studies, but this is related to bringing the state into federal compliance. We are recommending that we align the family, child foster care, and adoption background studies with the federal Adam Walsh Act Criminal History Record Check Authority, and also align with the federal child care rule, where notification to a child care provider and prospective child care staff member when the prospective child care staff member can work under supervision and when they may not work. And the last proposal is about the EIDBI provisional licensure and program integrity. I think this committee is aware that there has been significant growth because of significant need for this service. And together, the legislature, previously with the legislature, we allowed for this service to come into our Medicaid program because of the great need in the state. And now we are recommending that we put some additional controls around it through provisional licensure. We'd like to, the recommendation is to institute a provisional license for EIDBI programs, to implement maltreatment investigation authority, which we currently don't have, to shorten the revalidation cycle for service providers, to update systems to ensure providers clear a background study prior to providing being enrolled in providing services, and clarifying employer-employee requirements. Elise?
Chair Schumacher, members of the committee, I'm going to go over the remaining proposals within the governor's budget, as well as a few items from direct care and treatment. So going into the behavioral health changes in the governor's budget, on slide 44, you'll see the substance use disorder treatment and service changes. The goal of this proposal is to really enhance our program integrity around behavioral health substance use disorder treatment services, as well as easing some workforce challenges that we're seeing in the SUD treatment professional lane. So what we're planning to do here is to establish 6 new billing codes for counseling, psychoeducation, and recovery support services. Currently, SUD services are billed in 1-hour increments under either an individual counseling or a group counseling billing code. But these codes don't differentiate between the type of counseling being provided or other allowable treatment activities. We're also hoping to align with ASAM 4th edition standards in this change, create transparency, and accurately reflect the services being rendered. So we would disaggregate into the 6 billing codes. The billing codes would then be transitioned from a 1-hour unit to a 15-minute unit. That will enable us to ensure that the billing matches the services being provided to each individual person. And then lastly, we're looking to address the workforce shortages by adjusting the qualifications based on those individual service lines, where when a service requires a higher level of professional, maintaining that requirement, and when the service does not require that higher level of professional, easing those qualification requirements so that we can get more people into the workforce. The next slide goes over some changes we're recommending on recovery residences. So recovery residences are formerly known as sober homes. And we're looking to bolster the oversight over those residences and increase the protections of people who are living in those residences. So a few things here. We're looking to create a certification process for recovery residences. While the 2023 legislature enacted some requirements on this, no authority was designated to enforce the standards. To ensure recovery residences are following the best practices, this proposal would establish a certification process and would align with the existing standards identified in Minnesota law right now and incorporating the standards established by the National Association of Recovery Residences, or NAR2. We would join 36 other states across the country in aligning our standards in recovery residences with these. So what this proposal does is establish a certification process that DHS would administer, aligning with the NARR Level 1 and 2 standards. Responsibilities at DHS would include an initial certification of the residences, investigating complaints, conducting recertifications every 3 years, maintaining a public database of certified recovery residences, and decertifying as needed when the residences go out of commission. We would also be responsible for publicly reporting investigation findings within the recovery residences. Recovery residences wouldn't be required to receive a certification. However, another aspect of this proposal is adding the ability for these residences to enter into housing support agreements with DHS to ensure that we're paying for adequately paying for the room and board costs that exist within recovery residences. So in order to receive housing support under this proposal, recovery residences would need a certification through DHS. As part of this, we're also phasing out freestanding room and board. So freestanding room and board was a model that was established many years ago at the legislature to address a reported lack of residential treatment programs across the state. However, we're finding now there's a lack of oversight and authority over these programs, as well as continued growth, raising concern about potential inappropriate billing practices. Providers in this mode don't have to go through the same strenuous licensure processes as residential treatment providers. People in recovery residences also lack access to housing if they were to leave, because freestanding room and board is directly for the provider. So we're looking to shift freestanding room and board into housing support, which is a program that we have standards around and contracts with providers, and a person is would be eligible on their own, as well as on the provider side would be eligible. And if a person leaves that residence, they would continue to access housing support if they move to another residence that is a provider who is eligible to serve in the housing support program. We're also looking long term and kind of thinking about how to adequately fund housing options for people living in recovery residences. We know that housing is a huge barrier for people in their recovery process, and so we would really like to tackle this program, this problem long term, and we'd like to work with the community and other stakeholders around what are the best long-term solutions in that regard. And I lost it. There we go. So going on to the next one, these are proposals around behavioral health, the Behavioral Health Fund. So the Behavioral Health Fund was established in 1986 to provide funding for substance use disorder treatment in the state. The Behavioral Health Fund predated behavioral health parity laws and was established at a time where Medicaid didn't cover the current array of billable SUD activities. So there's some remaining kind of items within the Behavioral Health Fund that we fund that don't necessarily align with our current long-term or our current SUD and mental health continuum. So we're proposing to make some changes within that as such. So the first item in this proposal is limiting the eligibility to 60 days. So within the Behavioral Health Fund, we pay state-only funds for an individual when they're seeking SUD treatments. And that can last up to a year. But we're finding that because the eligibility requirements are really very, very, very similar to the requirements on Medicaid, that it would be best for the individual for them to receive the comprehensive health care benefit under the Medicaid program rather than only receive just straight SUD services. So this proposal institutes a 60-day limit where the person would be able to access SUD services right away, but then that within that 60 days they would apply for Medicaid. This will incentivize access to more comprehensive health care for the person while at the same time reducing state costs, because in the behavioral health funds, these are 100% paid state funding. The next proposal is increasing the county share in the behavioral health fund. So currently, under current law, counties pay 22.9%, and this proposal seeks to increase that up to 50%. except for when the services are provided in a carceral setting. And then lastly, we're proposing to remove the local agency allocation. So this allocation predates the current direct access rule, where it was intended to reimburse counties for the role they played in doing assessments for folks and finding SUD care for them. Now that we have direct access, this administrative funding is no longer going to what it was originally intended. Okay, diving into a few other extraneous proposals throughout our budget. So one key fiscal cliff that we're seeing in the future here is around the services we provide for HIV. We have a federal funding cliff coming up in the next fiscal year of about $9 million per year ongoing. So this proposal provides a one-time $6 million investment to mitigate or slow down that cliff. These HIV services are really critical for the state. We're seeing an increase in the number of new HIV diagnoses. We served about 10,000 people last year, and I believe the increase in the new diagnoses between 2022 and 2023 increased by 24%. So while we're having a reduction in funding, we're seeing an increase in demand and importance for these funds. These funds are really critical because a person who has the services and are able to access the drugs to help them, they aren't able to transmit the virus to any other person. So it's critical for Minnesota that we maintain the level of services needed to get a handle on the outbreak and eventually, you know, end HIV in Minnesota. Housing stabilization services is another important service within this committee's jurisdiction. This is a service provided under the Medicaid program that assists older adults and people with disabilities, including those with mental health and substance use needs, to keep and find housing. This was a new benefit implemented only a few years back. And since implementing that benefit, we've found that we were now close to double the number of people receiving the services than we originally anticipated. We were the first nation in the country in 2020 to implement this kind of benefit in Medicaid. So there was little known about how many people would be served and how many providers would take up the benefit. DHS plays a critical role in housing stabilization services, where we are determining eligibility both on the provider side and on the person side. And so that means a lot of staff power to process those applications. Given the demand for the services much higher than originally anticipated and originally funded, we are seeing about a three-month processing delay when a person wants to receive housing support or housing stabilization, excuse me. So in this proposal, we're seeking just three FTEs to add to our capacity to improve our access for people for this important service, as well as to provide training and technical assistance to providers. When we have such a high demand for a service and limited capacity to meet that demand, it's really important for us to work with providers on the front end on what's the requirements of the program, what it entails, rather than on the back end. The next page goes over a few grant and administrative reductions we're proposing. So we have one small grant, a local planning grant, that's an ongoing grant that we don't receive very many, if any, some years of applications to receive the funding. So we are proposing to eliminate that grant. We also have a contract, the Drug Effectiveness Review Project contract, that helps us work with other states around drug coverage decisions. We're proposing to eliminate that contract as well, and you'll see the savings for both of these items combined on the slide. As part of the governor's budget, we are also looking to receive an operating adjustment. So the way the appropriations to state agencies work is they're, of course, flat over time. And at the same time, our cost of operations rise each year as far as healthcare, taxes, salary and compensation related costs, the costs of rent and lease, fuel, utilities, and IT and legal services grow. And so this proposal requests a portion of that increase in the costs to maintain our current level of services. We're also requesting funding to fund the Commercial Source of Income Service, so CSI. This is a service that we use currently to verify the income eligibility for Minnesota Healthcare Program applicants and enrollees, so Minnesota Care and Medicaid applicants and enrollees. This has always been funded to states, 100% federal funding. However, the feds have now said that states would now have to incur a state match, and that will be about 25% of the cost of the service. So the costs in this proposal are the state costs of what that will cost the state to ensure that we can adequately verify eligibility for the programs. We have a few budget neutral proposals. So the first one is the Medicaid Disability Determination Enhancements. The state at DHS has the State Medical Review Team, or SMART team, and they help assess a person's eligibility for disability programs or long-term care programs. And we're proposing to kind of ease and smooth the process for doing that by allowing us to access the electronic health records at Minnesota medical providers, and then on the provider side to allow them to receive electronically signed authorizations to release records. We're looking to streamline our processes to reduce the manual amount of work and paperwork, and resulting in faster and more accurate medical reviews, which to date is a long process sometimes that people have to wait for to go through the SMART process. We're also looking to update the statutes related to VADD, which is Vulnerable Adult Developmental Disabilities Targeted Case Management Service. We want to clarify that tribes are an allowable provider of this service, and acknowledge their unique federal payment structure as different from any other payment. We have a technical proposal in your book as well, and this one's kind of wonky, but it's really updating our accounting structure at DHS to align with the new organizational changes. So, of course, we shifted a lot of the children and family budget out of DHS, but there were remaining grants that kind of existed in different accounts. And we also reorganized as an agency. We've taken behavioral health and put that in its own administration, and housing programs in their own administration as well. So it's important that our accounting structure really matches with a transparent way to understand where the funds sit. So that's the majority of this proposal. We also have a few conforming changes that passed in the last few years that were technical errors in the bill, such as making sure our MnChoices assessment timelines are valid across all of the long-term care continuum. And then lastly, last year, this committee passed the 1115 reentry program, which allows us to apply for a waiver from the federal governments to provide health care to people exiting incarceration. As part of that, we had state-funded grants for entities that will be participating in that pilot, which include local prisons and local jails, and there's a lot of work on their side to even get ready for that. Do I have an electronic health record, for instance, to build the Medicaid agency? And so this proposal would clarify state law that we can pull down a federal match on that state funding, and then that match would go into more grants for those entities. The next proposal is looking to ease some manual work around payments that we send to tribal nations and counties, specifically around the Adult Mental Health Initiative and traditional healing programs. So we're looking to, rather than have grant contracts with each entity of these local governments for the same programs year after year, we're looking to shift that to direct payments and transition the requirements into state law rather than have onerous grant and time-consuming grant requirements with these entities that are other government agencies. Okay, moving into direct care and treatment, we have three proposals that I'll briefly go over. The aggregate impact of these proposals are $13.6 million in 26-27. And $34.1 million in 28-29. As with DHS, the direct care and treatment will require an operating adjustment to maintain their services. Direct care and treatment is a unique entity, though, across all of the enterprise, because they're a large, highly specialized behavioral health care system where we're serving more than 12,000 patients each year. And this is a unique and vital role because we're serving people that can't find access to care elsewhere in the system. Our costs rise each year due to increases in healthcare and salary, rent, lease, fuel, utilities, IT, and legal services. We also don't have a choice to turn the lights off or, you know, not have staff available to care for people. It's a 24/7, 365-day operation. So it's important to maintain the same level of services that we have today at minimum. So this proposal is just looking to increase the appropriation for operations in order to do that. During the 2023 legislative session, state law was passed to address competency proceedings that were added to Chapter 611. Under the new process now, individuals will be admitted for treatment under this authority rather than the previous authority where they would have been civilly committed or referred for inpatient competency examinations under Rule 20. As of the end of October 2024, when the change page was written, we hadn't received any referrals, but we do anticipate that, the 611 client population will be essentially the same as the former Rule 20 client population, where we were able to have cost of care collections to pay for the cost. Sorry, I'm losing my spot. So without clarification for the ability for us to collect the cost of care, we would have a loss to the general fund as a result of not being able to collect that revenue. So this proposal would restore the ability for us to charge costs for that care. The second part of that proposal is to clarify that we're able to share data with the county prosecutors, defense attorneys, and the court. In our role as a competency attainment program. So this will really be important to ensure that we have improved data, better collaboration, and more efficient services for the people involved with criminal proceedings and working towards competency attainment. Current statutes doesn't give us clear authority for data sharing with the county prosecutors and defense attorneys litigating the criminal cases. And data sharing related to care coordination and pre-trial supervision is really necessary in order to adequately follow through on what's intended in the program. For example, forensic navigators are required to report pre-trial violations to the court under Chapter 611, but DCT is not authorized under the current statutes to share the violations with those forensic navigators of the patients in our programs. Lastly, this will be really important when it comes to discharge and care coordination outside of the program. So the current statute doesn't permit us to share information for that purposes, and so we think it would benefit the person as well as we're thinking about what's next. Lastly, we're looking to increase the county cost of care for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So DCT provides treatment to individuals who are court-ordered to receive sex offender treatment in a secure setting. Currently, we serve around 740 people. And currently, counties share a cost in the care for clients admitted to MSOP. And so this proposal would change what that percentage is. Currently, it's around 10% for people who were admitted prior to August of 2011. And then 25% for people who were admitted after that date, as well as when people are on discharge, provisional discharge. This proposal would change that to 40% for all individuals. And lastly, I'll just point you to the governor's budget book. I've got some links in the slide, as well as our website around our legislative information. With that, we'll stand for questions.
Thank you for the presentation this morning, and congratulations, Commissioner Gandhi, for your role, temporary as it may be. Appreciate the information here and the ability to do the department overview and the budget in 75 minutes. That's great. Thank you for that. We'll start with questions. Representative Franzen has the first question.
Thank you.
Representative Franzen, could you flip your switch?
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. So back to the fraud prevention. When you are investigating the child care assistance program, are you also, if they're frauding CCAP, most likely then they are frauding the food program as well. Are you also looking into that area, or are you like, that's a federal program, that's not our issue?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, Representative Franzen. I would like to, I don't want to answer incorrectly. I'd like to check with our OIG staff and see specifically, but my understanding is that within the scope of our ability to share data, that we do look at individuals who are under investigation in one program to see if there are other payments going on in other programs.
Okay. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're not really sure if that's being done is what I'm understanding. That's what I'm hearing.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Franzen, I'm 9 days into understanding the detailed workings of OIG, so I just would like to, somebody is sure it's not me at this moment, but happy to get back to you with that information.
Great.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next thing is talking about license capacity versus the amount of kids that are registered. Do you look at that as an indication that there could be sketchy things going on at that location? For example, if the license capacity is 78 kids, but there's maybe 259 that are registered, one would think that's more than three shifts in a 24-hour period, and there could be some things going on there that are probably not proper. Are we looking at that as well?
Commissioner Gotti.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, Representative Franzen. Our licensing team has many factors that they look at related to the licensing standards and the operations, the hours of operations, what they're licensed for, staffing, and would be happy to work with you and share what we're able to that doesn't sort of compromise the way our investigatory team works.
Mm-hmm. Representative Franzen.
I'll let others continue on.
All right. Thank you, Representative Franzen. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Gandhi and Assistant Commissioner Mertz and Director Bailey. I think thanks for sharing the presentation recommendations. I understand and we understand the challenges that we're faced with this budget, but this recommendation, quite frankly, falls short in some areas. We understand that we have to continue to work together in a collaborative way to find a balance in this process. Mr. Chair, I'm optimistic that by working together collaboratively, we can come up with a solution that meets the needs of Minnesotans, particularly individuals who are elderly or disabled individuals. This budget cuts short on all of them, and it's going to be difficult for us to address the needs of Minnesotans if we don't come up with a good plan. With that, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask a quick question. Was the impeding budget cuts that we see that are coming in the pipeline from the federal government factored into the decision-making of this budget recommendation? Do we have a clear vision what may be happening at the federal level that will significantly even impact the current proposal?
Thank you, Representative Knorr.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr, I think that's a great question. The answer is no, because we don't have definitive information on what exactly will happen on a federal level. We are assessing that, and I would say we are worried about that, as are you, I'm sure. And so I think throughout session, as things progress on the federal level, we'll definitely have to keep that into consideration as far as what solutions are feasible on the state side versus what's coming down the pike on the federal side. For example, there's been a variety of ideas floated out there, from work requirements to, you know, changing the FMAP amount to doing per capita caps. And each one of those items will drastically impact us in different ways. And so it's kind of hard to do analysis right now when we don't know exactly what's real on the table.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. My first question is for Ms. Bailey. Could you just walk us through what it's like on page 18? I believe I heard you say there's been an increase in kids in long-term care. And, you know, what does it look like when people get enrolled? I think you said in long-term care. I just wanted to just to understand that piece a little bit. Thank you,
Director
Chair.
Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, yes, we've seen an increase in the number of kids receiving home and community-based services. So the increase in those accessing our disability waivers. And so when it comes to a child accessing those waivers, my understanding they need to meet the income requirements for MA, as well as the functional requirements to accessing long-term care. So that would be the MinChoices assessment as well. And then the county or lead agency worker would be working with that child and the family to authorize services on their behalf to meet their needs. So it's similar to an adult basically accessing the long-term care continuum.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, thank you so much for that. And now going over to page 22, I believe that might be Ms. Bailey, but I'm not sure. When we look at full-time employees here. So when I look at this graph from 2024 to 2025, curious, is this including still all of you know, the other departments that were taken out, the children's and families, full-time employees, is that all still included in here, or is that separate? That's my question.
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman. This would include the budget and the number of people in DHS and DCT, because direct care and treatment had not yet shifted out of our agency, but it would not include the children, youth, and families, because effective in 25, those funds and the FTEs along with those funds had moved.
Representative Gilman.
Oh, good point.
Director
and
Bailey.
A portion of, sorry, there's a small portion of direct Department of Youth and Children, Youth, and Families that remains in DHS this fiscal year, and those are the Office of Inspector General employees and funding. That oversee the licensing and the program integrity aspects of the programs that DCYF will administer. So those will shift in June of this year. So they would still be within those numbers as well.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Bailey, for that clarification. So, and I believe I heard another presentation earlier this week or last week. But it looks like we added another 682 full-time employees to those other departments. And it's hard when it's not reflected here. I mean, I know that things have shifted, but we have actually increased or had to increase when we took the children and families out of this. We had to add, I think it was like 680-some employees. I just wanted to make sure that's correct.
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, I heard that too, and honestly, that number surprised me. I think what would be helpful for your committee to see the FTEs that were in DHS that moved, the FTEs that were in the other agencies that moved, and what were the new FTEs. So I will commit to working with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families to get you that.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much. And my last follow-up to piggyback off of Rep. Franzen's comments on fraud. I would just like to ask Chair, and I don't know who this would be to, but how much money has DHS been able to recover from the fraud that has been made public over the last several years? Because it's in the millions and millions.
Who would like that?
Hundreds of millions.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, I don't have a number, but would be happy to go back to the team and get that for you. What I do know globally is that the amount of fraud that we find is less than 1% in our programs. And from the tips and data analytics, when we investigate fraud, about 80% or investigate some allegation, I won't say fraud, some allegation, about 80% of the time, what we find are administrative issues, and about 20% of the time, fraud, where we refer that on to an agency to investigate and prosecute. So that's just roughly generally all programs.
Representative Gilman.
So thank you for that. I do want to just say, like, when we start seeing major cuts, like in our SUD, and you know, they might look like small numbers, but when you hear less than 1% in fraud, I think about that number when you talk about this overall budget and how important those dollars would be to capture, so we could take care of the most vulnerable in our state. It's frustrating, and I hope that this committee can work collaboratively to figure out ways, instead of adding more FTEs, you know, maybe it's processes. I mean, there's other states that are doing amazing things, taking a Social Security number, running it through an AI database, and going, oh, this Social Security number might be here, here, and here, and used many different ways. I mean, there's so many things that other states are doing to tackle this, so we can have dollars available. The fact that counties right now are going to have to sit with a proposed budget of 40% increase to a county that is housing folks that need support and treatment and care, I think it's unrealistic. So I understand you're saying it's only 1%, but that 1% is a huge number when you're talking this big of a budget. And it's we have to figure out how to tackle it. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. So a lot of us know already, disability services have never gotten to a place of true full funding. Every single time, you know, in my work in the disability services for over 20 years, each time funding is requested, we've either gotten a no, or maybe a fraction of the funding required. And as, of course, time continues, costs continue to rise. And so just, you know, looking at the governor's budget, I'm really, really concerned, because we have never been in a place where, you know, providers are actually getting adequate funding to provide the services that people are receiving, right? And so, like, saying that we have even enough to cut right now just sort of baffles me, coming from the governor's budget. And knowing that we have over, just in the state of Minnesota alone, there's over $5 billion of unpaid labor with family members who are caring for their family members with Alzheimer's disease, dementia, just that, you know, that type of service where people are caring for their family member at home, but not through a provider, not getting paid. So at some point, if those families decided that they should opt in and try to get paid services, that alone would add $5 billion to this budget. That would just be an astronomical blow to our state's budget. So just sort of considering, like, we have severely underestimated the true cost in Minnesota of what it takes to really truly care for people. So I'm really, really deeply concerned about any suggested cuts in this area in the governor's budget. And considering federal cuts and tariffs, you know, providers are going to need to absorb those costs in the materials they buy and the groceries they buy and all those things too. And so I have a question for Director Bailey. Is the 2% inflationary cap in the proposal, is that per year or for the biennium?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Cran. It's per adjustment, per every other year, and I would acknowledge there was some lack of clarity in our change page around that, but that is what the total number represents, is only 2% every other year.
Representative Cran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. And I think we could all agree that, you know, putting a cap in the first place, I think, is a dangerous thing to do. Putting it at 2%, disability services will always take what we can get, but operating with under this constraint is going to be really, really, really difficult. And it's going to impact the people receiving services, and that's what we care about most. Another thing I just wanted to mention, thank you for addressing the HIV funding. I think it's important here that we acknowledge that we made it easier last biennium for people to access PEP and PrEP. And so we are currently on target to be in a really good spot to combat HIV spread in Minnesota now that people can access PEP and PrEP the way they need to. And so, again, I'm really, really worried about the progress we could be making in combating a public health crisis when we just got folks access to the meds that are going to stop these outbreaks from happening. So whatever, you know, we can do together to work on trying to limit any cuts to HIV funding. I mean, we're just in a prime spot right now to lower those numbers in Minnesota. So just wanted to throw that out there and thank you for including that in your presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Curran, Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So when DHS came before the Legislative Audit Commission, at that point I had asked a question about bringing in outside agencies and something external to be auditing DHS. And so I guess I was surprised when we get to page 37 and it states increased staffing in the agency for program integrity, increased staffing in the agency for integrity and provider eligibility. Again, next bullet, increased staffing, increased funding. The following page, expanded authority. And then it goes on to really, in my view, kind of pass the buck and say that you don't have authority to do many of the things that the private sector would just naturally do if there's fraud and abuse. You would just take the necessary steps, and here you're asking for authority to do that. So I find all that problematic, but my specific question then is, have you brought in any outside agencies so it's not just the fox guarding the hen house, so to speak?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Jacob, thank you for the question. I also want to just go back to Representative Gilman's statement and say that I agree with you. I did not say it's only 1%. I said it was less than 1%. And I agree that even less than 1%, when we're talking about this amount of funding, is a lot of money. My point is that there is a large portion of funding in DHS for human services that goes to really good, well-meaning providers that are serving the people of Minnesota well. And so I don't want the bad actors to cast doubt on the services that we're providing to the people of Minnesota. Representative Jacobs, I come from the private sector, and I have found some of the rules different. We as a state agency, we are only allowed to do what is within the authority we are given to do. And so absolutely would like to make changes that allow us to be more nimble and take the kind of actions that you're suggesting. I think that would be very helpful to state agencies. To your question about outside organizations, we are audited by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We are very transparent with them, happy to partner with them, have them examine whatever scope that they would like to within DHS. And in terms,
That's okay.
In terms of outside partners, we do work very closely with the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. We work with federal partners like HHS, OIG, to take referrals to the fraud that we find.
Representative Jacob.
I didn't see that in any of the information. It seemed to me your answers were there is fraud and abuse. The solution is give us more employees and expand our authority. That's what I saw in here. I didn't think that looked good.
Commissioner Grande?
Chair Schumacher, Representative Jacob, thank you for that comment. The reason that we are recommending this is, one, these investments in our program integrity office have a return on investment for every dollar invested. We avoid 1.89 in costs. So we either avoid those expenditures or we recoup those funds. So there is good return on investment for the staffing investments we are asking for. And giving us additional authority will allow us to be more nimble and take the actions that you're suggesting the private sector is able to take.
Representative Jacob.
Well, my thought process on that is the reason it's 1.89, the reason that's so high is because there's so much fraud to uncover. I mean, if it wasn't there and we weren't expanding the authority, it needs to be an outside investigation into this. I just don't agree with expanding staffing, and that's all I need. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And members, we have about 9 minutes left. I have next Fisher, then Gander, Frederick, then Murphy, Keeler, then Gordon, Vernick, and Hicks. Some of you are going to be disappointed when 10 o'clock comes and we gavel out, but just to give you that. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Very quickly, I'll move on through these. Very disappointed that in the mental health, first of all, thank you for the presentations. I was disappointed to see nothing, though, in the mental health area. This is an area that we know that we had the rate study done over the last couple of years that showed there's a great need for out there. Was curious why we're not seeing anything happening in that area with the amount of boarding we have that's happening out there, along with I didn't see anything from DCT is what they're doing to address additional capacity for kiddos and for adults in there. So I want to call that out. I don't need a response on it. Just want to highlight these for right now. And then number two, I want to say that I do want to thank the team for the years that they've worked with us on policy. We've got a number of policy things that will be coming forward this year in the mental health area, and look forward to working with the department as we're working in a bipartisan way to address the needs in the mental health area. Thank you.
Thank you for getting that in the record. Representative Fisher, Representative Gander.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. First of all, I would ask that probably we shouldn't talk about the percentage of fraud, waste, and abuse that we have when we're building out our capacity to find such things. Okay, we're saying we can do a better job of identifying fraud, waste, and abuse, but on the front end of this whole process, we're saying it's less than 1%. Those two don't add up. They don't connect, because we're going to do a better job of finding it, and as we do, we're going to say the percentage is probably higher than we initially thought. So I'd just be hesitant to quote a statistic like that on the front end as we're undertaking this exercise. Next, I think about in healthcare, we have what we refer to as a gatekeeper in terms of healthcare, and that tends to be a primary care provider. Maybe it's an HMO or a PPO, and that gatekeeper then helps to allocate care to specialists appropriately and not over-refer, but to constrain the cost and the utilization. The concern I think I have with all of this is there are too many gates to come into this whole process. It looks like the federal gate, you know, with SSI determination, there appears to be a state gate coming in for folks to utilize these services, and there's a county gate to come into these services. We need to pay attention to all of those gates so as to, again, optimize the utilization of these services and not have folks in there that maybe shouldn't be qualified for the services. So really paying attention to those several gates is going to be of utmost importance. And finally, the question that comes off of that is, when in the governor's budget proposal there is this recommendation to put some costs onto the county in these several areas, how much of that is, number one, we think the county should pay more. Number two, we think they can do it more efficiently. Number three, maybe they are letting folks in who wouldn't have to be there, and that would bring some cost containment. So when we think about some of the costs going to the county, what do we anticipate will happen there? What is our read of the situation that they will be able to process that additional cost factor or a reduction in people that they qualify? Thank you.
Who would like that question? Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative. I would say that the state has been moving in a continuum for many years on people wanting to live at home and have their own apartment or receive home and community-based services in their own setting versus in a residential setting. And so the legislature and the governor has been moving that way for quite some time from a policy standpoint. So a lot of the vision behind why the residential share, why is it just on residential, and why is it on provider-controlled residential where a person doesn't have a lease or any kind of legal rights around the space they're living in, is really to incentivize not only from a cost growth standpoint, they cost 3 to 4 times more than any other service plan, but also from a standpoint of knowing that a lot of people with disabilities, not everyone, you know, sometimes those services are what exactly they want and they should be able to have access to them. But sometimes they would like to move into their own home. And I think from the lead agency perspective, that's a challenge, putting together a service plan that fits that person's needs outside of a residential setting, because it takes a lot more work pulling together different providers. And that's kind of a tug and pull we've worked on for many, many years. And so there is a bit of the proposal that is around incentivizing moving that direction when it works for that person. The other part of the proposal is we have a deficit and we're looking for areas that to work with that deficit, frankly. And so that's what I would say. There's a little bit of both in the proposal.
Representative Gander.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question would be to Director Bailey, but when it talks about the substance use disorder service changes and the change in the billing from an hour down to 15-minute units, what we've seen in the last year is that some organizations that are can bill for an hour, but they're only required to actually provide services for like 35 minutes or so, and then they start up the next hour, quote unquote, at the 45-minute mark. So there's that overlap. So part of this change to go down to a 15-minute interval is there also language that the department is advocating for to ensure that when billing is turned in, that there there's a max of like 4 units or whatever per hour that it can be max turned in.
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Frederick, I'm not sure if we have max billing limits in here. I can get back to you on that. But to your original kind of statement about the intent of the proposal, it is very much about ensuring compliance with the midpoint rule, which exists in another proposal as well as making sure that the state dollar is being paid for the services delivered. But I can get back to you on what is the maximum amount of units that could be billed in a day.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess last question then for now would just be that the housing supports in the SUD space, is that going to impact, we talked about sober homes or the recovery residences, is it also going to impact RCOs at all?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Frederick. I'd have to get back to you on that too as well. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Director Bailey. Just looking at page 22, it shows that the administrative budget is like $25.7 billion, and we have 6,908 employees. That's a really big number per employee. First of all, can you help me with why? But I'm also wondering what percent of the human services employees work from home, and do they get a home office allowance? And if so, what is it?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative. So orienting you to the slide 22, the $25 billion is our total budget. So not on how much we spend for administrative costs. Administrative costs, including IT and salaries, are 2% of our budget. So it would be way lower than the 25. To your question on folks working remotely, I can get back to you. I don't have those numbers. We do not give an administrative allowance for
staff that work at home.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's fine.
All right. Final question today. Representative Keeler.
Thank you. Sorry, I was flipping too many pages. I'm trying to keep up. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My questions are going to be for Director Bailey. Page 29 for those who are following. I'm really, really concerned about the reduction. I've talked to you about it. I've had many conversations in my community and statewide about this reduction to the 351 days and the assumption that comes with that. I've talked to you about this, that there's 365 days in a year, and there's this assumption that's taking place that the individuals who utilize this service don't need the service for 2 weeks out of the year. Is that what the assumption is?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Keeler, no. So the way that the rates are set is there's a bunch of different cost components that kind of add into a rate. And one of the cost components is the absence and utilization factor, which accounts for the time that a person isn't receiving services, but the provider still incurs the costs, but they can't bill, right? So if I'm living in a residential setting and I want to go home and visit my parents for the weekend, that means the provider can't bill for services they're not providing for me, but they still probably maintain the staffing to manage the home. And so we increase the rate by 3.9% so that on the aggregate across the year, they still maintain the level of revenue that they would need to maintain services.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so, but I think what I'm trying to say is that what you said in the idea that people are going home and spending days with their family, for some of the individuals we provide services for, they're just not able to do that. And so we just need some clarification because I'm getting a lot of questions from my community, and I'm sure all of you are too, on like if I can only bill, right, for so many days, and there was this increased rate that was a part of it, and then that's supposed to hold over. Our agencies are feeling like they're really going to miss out of money there, and I'm really concerned about that because I know for CCRI, and I just know in my community alone, we have individuals of such high need that they would love to go spend time with their families. They just can't, and they still need these services. So what I don't want to happen is them have to not be able to provide the critical services they need. I hope that we continue to look into that, but can you tell me what was the last amount of days that we could bill for? Was it 365 and we reduced it to 351?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Keeler, currently under current law, it's always been they can bill up to 365 days. So what the proposal is saying is because we increase the rate to pay for an additional 14 days, that will just align the billing units to what we're already paying for in the rate. So the intention is that the person would still maintain to receive the services because the provider is essentially getting paid up front in all the other days that they can bill. But they can't, we're not going to pay double. We're not going to pay for an absence factor in the rate as well as no absences throughout the year.
Representative Keeler, we anticipate that we'll need to ask these fine folks to come back. Assistant Commissioner Mertz, Commissioner Gandhi, Director Bailey, thank you for your time today and your presentation. As I mentioned, we will have them back when it works into the calendar to finish the questions that we have and get a better understanding of what the governor is suggesting we do this year. With that, we are adjourned until Tuesday, February 18th. We get to come back at 8:15.